Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious as we listen to a program originally broadcast in May of 1997. I'm Barry Vogel. Some people's memories of President Richard Nixon are due in part to his negative role in escalating the Vietnam War, the student demonstrations at Kent State University, and Nixon's ultimate downfall in Watergate. But who was the man? And how could another individual get close to him? Crazy Rhythm, my journey from Brooklyn, jazz, and Wall Street to Nixon's White House, Watergate, and beyond, is a story written by a complex man very close to Richard Nixon. Attorney Leonard Garment was born to Jewish immigrant parents in New York in 1924. Playing music, especially saxophone jazz, he grew up in Brooklyn. As a good student and with what he describes an ambition to run things, Garment finished law school in his early 20s and began working for a major Wall Street law firm. Even though at times he characterized himself as a liberal Democrat, Garment became a close friend and law partner with Richard Nixon, and later became the attorney for and the counsel to President Richard Nixon during the time Nixon was embroiled in the throes of Watergate. I want to begin in the introduction. You say that our ways, Nixon's and mine, of adapting inner need to outer circumstances had enough resonance to bring us together. Mm-hmm. What was your inner need?
Well, the inner need was the inner need of a lot of immigrant kids of my sort. That is the children of immigrants from Russia and Poland running around the streets of Brooklyn. And the inner need was to find a role, to find an identity, to fulfill our parents' ambitions for us.
But that's your parents.
Climb the pole, climb the ladder, and be there. New York was there, shining across the East River, the city for conquest. So that was kind of an inner need. Was that essentially an assimilated identity? And at that point, and the Nixon,
his inner need,
his own problems of that sort. His own inner need was to reestablish himself as a possible candidate for the presidency, to get himself into a new venue where he could practice law, at least superficially. I think with the determination to do his job, but also to prepare another base camp for still another assault on Mount Everest of American politics, namely the presidency. We both had mountains to scale in a way, and both of us, I think, needed the distraction of competitive activity to avoid problems of depression. Simple as that.
In the book where you talk about the time that you spent in the Nixon White House in the year or so prior to his resignation, was there ever a point where you felt a real obligation that you either pushed aside or pursued to investigate the reliable reports that you heard about Nixon that would affect you, like the tapes and the 18.5-minute gap? You were there as Nixon's advocate.
All of these things were being investigated by several hundred lawyers and...
Well, I know that, but you were Nixon's lawyer, and you were the person who spoke for him or provided him advice. And as an attorney, I find that to give the good advice, you have to know the truth. Otherwise, you have one hand strapped behind your back.
Barry, that was the heart of the problem, which is that he ran his own case, and he was dealing with it from the beginning. From the June, 25 years ago, June of 1972, right, pretty much the end, as a political problem that over which he would preside, and he'd give out those pieces of information that he felt he could make available to lawyers, so-called lawyers around him, and other people, without giving too much away. He knew, I think, that if he permitted us to have access to everything, that most of us, that is I, Fred Bazaar, some of the other lawyers, just would not be able to stay in the White House. So he kept that to himself. And he felt that if he lasted long enough, if he could get past the fall of 1974, the midterm elections, he probably could sweat it out to the end. But he didn't do it because the Congress decided to accelerate things, and then there was Deep Throat and all of that business.
Who was Deep Throat? Do you have any ideas?
Well, I have some ideas, but you know that's an area in which I think it's.
And you say there's maybe...
It's worse than pointless to speculate about people. Everybody's been doing that for years.
Sure.
And
you say there was one, and maybe there were many deep
throats. I think my general take on this is that there were several. There's more than one person in the Deep Throat chorus, and that there was a Pavarotti or a Lawrence Melchior who was belting out the principal songs and the main lines. For the Washington Post, for Woodward and Bernstein.
Well,
who that person, or say one or two people, were each, say, working collaboratively in developing the so-called persona of Deep Throat, may have been, is something that I haven't given up pursuing. And as a matter of fact, a fellow who knows a lot about all of this material, and I may be doing a little... addition to my book within the next year or so, if we're satisfied that we have determined beyond a reasonable doubt who it is, or who they are, or who she is.
and subject yourself to a potential libel case.
Don't spend your money on Crazy Rhythm. Wait for another year or two and read Throat.
Yeah. All right. I want to ask you... About one point in the book, you talk about how you were dispensing hopeless answers to an unanswerable press. How does that make you feel when you're standing there as the lawyer for the President of the United States doing that?
I've done that a lot of times as a lawyer. I mean, in the years I tried cases, I'd be making fairly hopeless arguments to an unresponsive court.
But that's different when you're talking to an unresponsive court. Here you're speaking...
The court, even an appellate court, doesn't yell at you the way 110 White House press people were during the time, saying, Len, what's all the BS? How can you? And why don't you level with us? Well, you know, I figured as a lawyer that if you get some... Start doing a lot of shouting, that in a way you may be performing your lawyerly function. They're losing their cool, and I didn't. That was the easy part of the job.
Did you know the answers to the questions they were asking when they say, how come you're not telling us?
No, I didn't, for the most part. And that's what I was trying to say, and that's what they found very unsatisfactory. This was one of the big press conference went off, I don't know, 2.5 hours. It was broadcast all over the White House, on the White House broadcasting system. It was the day of the release that we released the so-called May 22nd statement by the president, in which he revealed a lot of things, but essentially maintained that he was not involved and didn't know the crucial things. But he did reveal, the Ellsberg break-in.
Dr. Fielding's office.
In Dr. Fielding's office and various other things, and mail, the whole Houston plan involving mail covers and so on and so forth.
Were you aware of...
Basically, I said, well, you know, there are a lot of these things have been done for the past 20 years by other administrations. FBI stopped doing them. This administration started to consider doing it after the Ellsberg... massive leak of the Pentagon Papers and all of that, and it didn't go forward. Then they'd ask other questions and say, well, why don't you know? Tell us about this and that. I said, I just don't know. I'm trying to find out. It's a wonderful mystery that's in progress, and I'm just one of the persons trying to...
Yeah.
You see, I knew a lot of the press people, And though they did a lot of shouting and screaming, I think...
That was their job.
Yeah, members of the press believed me when I said I didn't know. But they had to do a lot of shouting and screaming. Of course, they were understandably frustrated with my inability to give them satisfactory, newsy sound.
Sure. At what point in time were you aware of the plumber's break-in into Dr. Fielding's office? He was the psychiatrist for Daniel Ellsberg.
I heard about that shortly before it became public.
But after the break-in? After it occurred?
Well, if you had me saying otherwise, I'd have to run and check the statute of limitations.
Oh, it's long past.
Yeah, it's all right. You can ask anything you want. No, it was after, and I don't know, a lot of these things were so strange. I've written about all of that in this book, partly why I call it Crazy Rhythm. And I've tried to, I think, the reviewers from the East Coast to the West Coast have been very generous, and including a lot of reviews who wouldn't give you the time of day for Richard Nixon, but I think find it interesting and sort of tries to state.
Well, let's stay.
Fairly.
Let's stay with.
You have to. And you've invited me to be on the show, so you must feel that it's not a lot of baloney.
Well, I listened to all of this stuff. I remember it very vividly on television and on the radio, and
there's never been. There's never been anything like it. And I guess we want to one would say abstractly, we hope there'll never be anything like it again, except that is not at all what most people would just love to have, that wonderful distraction of another Watergate.
Well, Len Garman,
I have a combination of insanity, crazy characters, you lots of witches, and a fellow with a trolley conductor's machine on his belt for coins to make.
Tony Ulasewicz?
Yeah, to cover up phone calls. He had to make so many that he had a trolley conductor's coin dispenser on his belt. I mean, that's riotous.
Yeah.
It's guys and dolls.
Yeah. Len Garman, I want to ask you about Ellsberg a little more,
Ellsberg.
But first I want to say, however, that my guest this week is Leonard Garman, who is an attorney now in Washington practicing public policy law, and he's the author of a new book called Crazy Rhythm, and about 25 years ago he was the White House attorney for Richard Nixon. Let's talk about Dan Ellsberg. Ellsberg tells us on Radio Curious that he wishes that he had released, or that the Pentagon Papers had been released 5 or 6 years earlier than they actually were.
Well, this may offend you, and it may offend a lot of your viewers, but if you want me to come on, and one of the curious things about me, I suppose, is that I try to say what I think.
That's why we want you on here.
In decent language, but straightforwardly. I mean, I think Ellsberg is a colossal ass, and that he was a colossally disloyal person.
Why?
When he did what he did. And it was not for him to determine what the law was. And it is, I suppose, there are whistleblowers who have done very good things in this country in connection with environmental disasters, in connection with racial misbehavior of a serious nature.
But who would determine who the law is wasn't a person who would release the papers as he did?
When I use language of that sort, Barry, it is with a certain amount of premeditation, and that's fairly mild. I don't think the country is yet absorbed the full complexity of those years and the whole terrible bloodletting, the almost insane stupidity of the engagement in Vietnam on the terms in which we engaged with the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, which was to do it piecemeal and force them into some kind of compromise and to reveal to them that we were not determined to win the war, and sacrificing so much treasure and more important, and so many lives.
What should we have done?
Well, I think we should have gotten... first of all, I don't think we should have gotten in on the basis in which first Kennedy, then Johnson, dragged the country into that war with McNamara still defending himself. I mean, it's unbelievable that people would permit him to continue as a member of the American elite and write books and attend book parties in his honor. I mean, I can't tolerate. I mean, I just can't stomach all of that. It's so phony and hypocritical. All right. A lot of things that were done then just were not understood by people. Johnson, we know now, knew in 65, 64, 65, the war was unwinnable. But for political reasons, he told the leadership, it's on tape by Johnson, that he couldn't end it. So they went on and they went on, and it was just the killing time. And finally, by 68, he couldn't bear it anymore, and that's when he bailed out. And Nixon made what history showed to be Nixon and Kissinger made the fatal error of deciding that they would undertake a massive strategic retreat, slow and steady, and thinking that they could do it within a year in a contained period of time. That is to withdraw from Vietnam gradually while maintaining the tension of the negotiating position with the Soviet Union and preparing the way for the opening to China to struggle in the Middle East to start some process going there. Dealing with an international mafioso of very hard-nosed, cold-eyed, brutal leaders. And so Nixon and Kissinger decided that this is the way they would do it, and they fell into this fatal trap because it didn't go on for 1 year. It went on for 2 years and 3 years, and more and more people became enraged at the continuing loss of life and the interior damage within the country, and more shouting and screaming. And, of course, along came Ellsberg, who, of course, was a Green Beret. I mean, he himself was... it is alleged by people that he performed some fairly tough and perhaps even brutal acts against the Viet Cong when he was over there.
Have you asked him about this?
Well, I made my views known to him very clearly. He knows that.
What's he respond? What's he say?
His response is that he has his own view. He's now running in the nuclear group. I mean, his whole life is now built around his drop of the Pentagon Papers, and Nixon and Kissinger made the terrible mistake that led straight to Watergate, which was to fight the papers. Nixon and Kissinger became enraged by that leak. That's what led to the creation of the plumbers to repair such leaks. Plumbers included a couple of, shall we say, slightly strange and irresponsible people. Charles Colson took the president's anger and angry orders very literally, and off they went, for which Nixon was responsible, and he bought into the very bitter wind of Watergate wars, and that's what brought about the destruction of his presidency.
When Nixon,
there are a lot of other factors, but
sure,
that's sort of a simple overall version of what took place. Now Ellsberg is still going around, like, you know, I am the law, I am above the law, Daniel Ellsberg. I wish I had done it sooner. And this is a kind of it's not unfamiliar in my belief. This is my belief and the belief of others. It is kind of, it's almost a megalomania to feel that he could have controlled the universe of life and death in Vietnam by blowing the whistle sooner in some way.
Yeah, I want to ask you something that you just mentioned about Colson.
This is one of the most self-righteous men I have ever met in my life. And there's a great old Irwin Shaw short story called The 80-Yard Run. A man who ran 80 yards in the first year of college for a touchdown, and for the next 35 years lived with that experience. And that's Daniel Ellsberg.
Yeah, well, I want to move on and ask you something that you said about Charles Colson a minute ago. And that's when you said that he took Richard Nixon's angry orders literally. When Nixon gave those orders, was that something that he consciously thought out and plotted, being the crafty politician, or was it a reaction to something that was happening?
Right. No, there was a mixture. I mean, there are some things that Nixon had wanted done, consciously, coolly, coldly, in terms of politics. You know, let's get those guys that are opposed to us. I mean, why are those people getting all the money? They're our enemies and they're screwing us. Why don't we screw them back? You know, that's ordinary political stuff on the inside. You don't say it publicly.
Yeah.
You don't release tapes.
Right, but he eventually did because he had to.
Well, you know, I mean, imagine releasing tapes of America's nighttime conversations at home, in bed, at a party, after a couple of drinks.
Sure.
No, it'd be pretty loathsome and quite interesting and quite zany. But that's, you know, that's called freedom of association, freedom of thought, and it's the heart of the whole business of First Amendment.
Yeah.
Freedom.
Yeah.
But you don't put those things on tape. If you do, you
you got to be careful. Trump. I got another question for you. You imply, I think, and my question is it an implication, that you say that the nation would accept the idea of a pardon from the new president, President Ford, and then you, in parentheses, say which was wrong. Are you implying...
It turned out to be wrong.
It did turn out to be wrong.
Well, it turned out to be wrong that they would accept it. I think it's now almost the conventional view that it was one of the wisest and most... prudential presidential acts of leadership by Jerry Ford.
Well, my question is...
He would have
been
a mess with a trial of Nixon.
Sure.
Trial for months, paralyzing everyone and everything.
And you make that very clear in your book.
Why was I wrong?
No. My question is, what message was sent to the American public when the highest leader of our nation is not held accountable for his acts?
Well, the message that's sent is one that's easily distorted. I mean, the message that was sent via the makers of messages and opinion and communication of value judgments, that is the media and again, our good old elite establishment, was that no man is above the law. And now that Nixon had... given up the presidency and relinquished the defense of presidential privilege from trial, he should be tried just like anybody else. This was the attitude of a lot of the press people who hated Nixon, really wanted to see him die. They didn't just want him to see him, they wanted him to retire. They really wanted to see him fry in Mazola oil.
Who's this?
A lot of the press people, I mean, and people on the intellectual left in good old New York and Washington. It was not enough that Nixon was disgraced and that he resigned. They wanted to have him tried. They wanted all of his ideas and his history revoked, abandoned, destroyed, redacted, expunged from the record of history. And that's what they were disappointed by. When Ford said, I'm pardoning this fellow, using the pardon power.
In selection of Ford as the replacement to Vice President Agnew, was there any discussion of this?
Barry, yeah. You got to let me finish a sentence.
All right, I thought I did.
No, I said that's why the president, the pardon power exists. The exercise, in order to spare the country, something that is more terrible than... A particular wrongdoer going free. Lincoln did it in a way that, of course, history now considers one of his wisest acts when he pardoned the in ex parte Milligan. The exercise, and it was determined by the Supreme Court, the president had the power to pardon all of the Confederate soldiers and leaders who had acted treasonously. If he didn't do that, of course, the country would be back having another civil war.
That's right.
And the Ford pardoned Nixon because, and he bit that bullet because he knew that if Nixon was transported around, in effect, like a freak in a cage or in a courtroom, through all of the savage battling and screaming and yelling between left and right and Republicans and Democrats, that would be a very horrible thing for the country.
Was there any discussion with Ford about this issue before he was appointed to replace Spiro Agnew?
Not that I know of. Certainly not by me, and I've never heard that it was even broached in the slightest way by anyone.
Well, Len Garment...
I have never even heard that suggested by anybody. People who have suggested everything.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting it. I'm just asking.
I understand.
Len Garment, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious.
I enjoyed it very much.
Time flies by, but before we close, I want to ask you the question I ask all of our guests at the end of a program, and that is, would you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
I'll tell you three very quickly. Two domestic and one foreign. Read them over one glorious four-day weekend when I just stayed in the house and got to bed to rest up from this book tour. Philip Roth's American Pastoral. Wonderful coming together of American history and a creative writer's life and work. Second American book, absolutely superb novella by Saul Bellow called The Actual, 104 pages of condensed wisdom and prose poetry with the Bellowian voice floating over you. Third would be, let me go to the foreign... I haven't finished the third one yet. That's also fine. But the third would be a novel. All three are novels. The third one is an older novel by a Czech writer named Rabl, H-R-A-B-L, Rabl. And I think it's a vintage book paperback. And it's called I Serve the King of England.
Well, thanks for joining us, Len.
Barry, and thanks for letting me blow away.
Attorney Leonard Garment is the author of Crazy Rhythm, My Journey from Brooklyn, Jazz, and Wall Street to Nixon's White House, Watergate, and Beyond. The books that he recommends are American Pastoral by Philip Roth, The Actual by Saul Bellow, and I Serve the King of England by a Czech writer whose last name is Rabl, H-R-A-B-L. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's U-K-I-A-H, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.